Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Spirit of Prophecy podcast. I am very fired up and excited about today's program. We are going to have Pastor Doug Wilson on the program. He is the senior minister of Christ Church in Moscow, Idaho. He is someone who is definitely of a different persuasion than I am when it comes to eschatology. But as you all know, if you've been watching this program for any length of time, I am not afraid to talk to the other side and to hear what they have to say and to give them an honest hearing. And his name has been recommended many times by whenever I have asked for suggestions on guests. And Pastor Wilson is a known voice in the world of postmillennialism. And so I want to hear what he has to say about the subject. He's also a big voice out there in the idea of Christian nationalism. And so what I decided we should discuss with him is how one's eschatology affects their politics, because I definitely think that there is, these things do affect each other. And in the futurist world, one of the things that concerns me a little bit is that we had, because of our eschatology that basically says everything's going to fall apart, the world's going to keep getting more wicked, we kind of have an attitude of just let's let it all go to pot. And we're not really standing strong against the forces of evil that are in our government. We're not really trying to change things. Some people, it's like they almost get excited as our country gets more wicked, because it's one more sign Jesus is about to come back. But the reality is we could be here for another few hundred years. That is possible. And the reality is we should be thinking about our children and our grandchildren and the world they're going to have to grow up in. And one thing that I've been thinking about a lot lately is that when it comes, I think one of the reasons we're seeing the mess we're seeing politically, the reason we're seeing the mess we're seeing doctrinally in churches today, is the previous generation of independent fundamental Baptists had no plans. They did not plan for 2025. They did not expect to be here in 2025. I don't know if y'all realize that. If you're from the premillennial futurist world, especially in the IFB, that previous generation did not plan for us being here in 2025. And I think we are reaping the results of that. And it doesn't mean our eschatology is wrong. It doesn't mean premillennialism is wrong. But this belief that everything is going to fall apart has affected how we have operated. And I believe it has caused us to go against certain principles of the scripture, you know, even if our eschatology is right. But then in the postmillennial world, they have more of an optimistic view of the world becoming Christian. And so it seems like people of that persuasion work a little harder at trying to affect things politically. And so I'm interested in what he has to say about our side when it comes to these things. And so I'm looking forward to this conversation. I'm very interested in what he has to say. I am not going to debate him on these things. I want to get his perspective. And I'm not real familiar with his ministry. I recently found out about him from watching Tucker Carlson. I saw that he was on there. I was very interested in that program. A lot of things he said I thought was very intriguing and interesting. Some things I agreed with. And then I watched another video about eschatology with him. And I was like, well, this is interesting, because he was saying some things I agreed with, some other things I didn't completely agree with. And so as his name kept being mentioned, I thought, yeah, I would love to have him on the program if he'd be willing to come on our humble program after being on ones like Tucker Carlson. So I reached out, and sure enough, he was willing. And so I appreciate that very much. And so I'm very excited about this. So let's hear what Pastor Wilson has to say about how your eschatology affects your politics. All right. Well, Pastor Wilson, thank you so much for coming on this program. It truly is a pleasure. I've been looking forward to this conversation for a while, but if you could just go ahead and maybe tell everyone a little bit about yourself and who you are in your ministry.
Sure. My name is Douglas Wilson. I'm the senior pastor of Christ Church in Moscow, Idaho. That's up in the panhandle of Idaho. Very beautiful country. And I've been the pastor here for almost 50 years. 48, 49, something like that. And we are basically Presbyterians who believe the Bible. I'd be the best. Presbyterians, not lesbyterians. And so my main vocation is that of a minister and a pastor, and I'm also a writer. I do a good bit of writing.
Okay. Well, yeah, so I have this podcast, and I've had many people recommend that I get you on the program. And I wasn't real familiar with what you do, but I saw you on Tucker Carlson. And I was very intrigued by that conversation. And I went back and I watched again. I don't know if there's a longer one out there. It was like a 17-minute one.
There's a longer. There's an hour-long one.
Okay. Yeah. I'd seen the hour-long one. I couldn't find that one again. I was just very interested by a lot of the stuff you said when I saw that, because there were many things I agreed with. And then I started watching some more of your things, and I saw you're more of the post-millennial persuasion, and a lot of people like to talk to you about Christian nationalism and all that stuff. Right. And just a thought that I have had, and I just really would be interested in your perspective, because I'm a Baptist. I'm from the Baptist world. That's most of who I've ever talked to, but I do enjoy talking outside my camp and learning some things. But in the premillennial world, it does seem like we do have a very pessimistic view of our, how things are going to end up. And as a result of that, it seems like it's reflected in our politics, where we're just kind of letting everything go to hell. And even when things get bad, everybody almost has this attitude, well, this is what's got to happen before Jesus comes back.
Right.
In the post-millennial world, you all seem to be a little more optimistic, seem to be a little more engaged and involved in these things. Do you feel like one's eschatology does affect their politics? And do you think that these are fair characterizations of the premillennial and postmillennial?
I think that that's mostly correct. I do believe that eschatology has a dramatic impact on things. But I know good premill brothers and all-mill brothers, Christians, who would have the same political positions that I would have. Mm-hmm. But what it mostly affects is your attitude and demeanor while you're fighting for them. There's a difference between playing on a softball team that knows it's going to lose mm-hmm. and playing on a team that thinks that there's a real prospect of winning versus a team that knows they're going to win. Right? You know, so there's a very dramatic difference. Now, you use the word optimism, which I like in this regard, but we have to make a distinction. All Orthodox Christians are optimistic ultimately. Mm-hmm. If we believe in heaven and hell, we believe that everything is going to be resolved and everything is going to be put right. How can you believe in heaven and not be optimistic? Right. Mm-hmm. Right. So all Christian positions are optimistic in that sense. But what you're talking about is optimistic about the course of human history before the Lord comes. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Optimistic about the next 10 years, or optimistic about how history is going to go. So with that said, I would divide the eschatological positions into two basic ones, borrowing the terms from the late Gary North. He said there's optimillennialism and pessimillennialism. Optimillennialism and pessimillennialism. Mm-hmm. Now, the post-mill position is optimistic by definition. Mm-hmm. Okay. But both the pre-mill and the a-mill positions, there is that option. So, for example, Charles Spurgeon was a great Baptist preacher in the 19th century, and he was premillennial, but he was not dispensational. And he was an optimillennialist. He believed that the Great Commission was going to be successfully fulfilled. He believed that the nations would come to Christ. He was an optimist about history, but he fitted that into a premill framework. Okay. So a dispensationalist would have to be a pessimillennialist, but you could be a premillennialist and be optimistic about human history. And of course, there are many a-mills who even call themselves optimistic a-mills. And I can't really tell the difference between them and the post-mills. But so what it boils down to is, if you're pre-mill, you could be optimistic and or pessimistic about the course of human history. If you're a-mill, the same thing. If you're post-mill, you have to be optimistic about history. That's sort of baked into the system.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. And what would you say, because that's something I've struggled with too, what would you say are kind of maybe one of the key differences between the A-mill and the post-mill position?
Most A-mills mm-hmm. believe that human history is going to stagger on pretty much the way it always has, not improving. And Christ is reigning with his saints in a spiritual sense in the heavenly realms. Mm-hmm. But that reign never manifests itself in any tangible way on earth. So we walk by faith. And then at some point, the end comes. So that's most amillennials. But some amillennialists are optimistic about the course of the gospel in history. And there's nothing in the system that requires that not happen. So, for example, when I was in the process of becoming post-mill, one of the books that I read that was really helpful in helping me to become post-mill was a book called Israel in the New Covenant by Roderick Campbell. And I just in big encouragement. But then after I was post-mill for a while, I found out that book was A-mill. I just assumed it was post-mill and it had helped me on my journey, but then, okay, no, it's A-mill.
Right. Yeah. And I'm glad you emphasized the fact that you can be pre-mill and still kind of have an optimistic view of human history. I don't think most pre-mill do, but I do think it's possible. And one of the things just in other conversations I've had with people, it does seem like there has been a great change in our thinking in the last couple of hundred years where we're not really about building civilizations, building things anymore. It has just been an attitude of it's fallen apart. And I think that can be seen in a lot of different things in our culture. We don't talk the way we used to. It's interesting listening to some of the old presidents talking about hundreds of years in the future and stuff like that. Yeah. Nobody talks that way anymore. And in the Christian world, nobody talks that way. Right. Do you think a lot of that, and maybe this is me just because of some of my hostility towards dispensationalism, but do you think a lot of that, the dispensationalism coming into American Christianity had a lot to do with that?
I do, frankly, mm-hmm. because people wanted to see their eschatology taking shape in the newspapers.
Yes.
Right. And what that meant was, if your eschatology has the Antichrist taking over and everything going to blazes at the end, and you think that that's when you're living, you're going to view all of our cultural battles as being comparable to the evacuation of Saigon. Mm-hmm. You know, God unfortunately got involved in a land war in Asia that he couldn't complete, and mm-hmm. we're going to helicopter out of here. Helicoptering out of here is the rapture. Mm-hmm. And you just sort of refuse to polish brass on a sinking ship. And then that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Mm-hmm. Christians who know better deliberately disengage with the cultural moment. And so consequently, that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy mm-hmm. because when the salt refuses to be salty and when the light refuses to shine, look what happens.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and one of the things too, I've been thinking a lot about too, just week and thinking about this conversation too, but the previous generation, you know, they're lamenting it, how things are in the fundamental world right now. But at the same time, it's like that previous generation, they did not prepare for a 2025. We were not supposed to be here in 2025. Right. I remember the preaching in the 90s. And even in the early 2000s, they were acting like, what are we still doing here? Here we are, 2025. And it's like, I do think the sad state we're in theologically is because they weren't preparing for a future.
Correct. That's right.
And I think a lot of what affected that, and this was something I think you had talked about on Tucker Carlson that really got my attention too, because again, being from the Independent Fundamental Baptist world, almost everybody is Zionist. Everybody is pro-Israel. But what are your thoughts on Zionism and how that's affected things?
So probably the best way for me to summarize it would be by saying I am pro-Israel and not a Zionist.
Mm. Okay.
So a Zionist, as I understand it, a Zionist is someone who holds that God has promised the land of Israel, the territory of Israel, to the Jews, and that they have a right to return to that land. The Zionist movement began in the late 19th century among Jews, mm-hmm. and among dispensationalists, there's a strong Christian Zionism that sees the formation of Israel in 1948 as the prophetic clock starting to tick again. Okay, so all of that, I am not persuaded at all of that. Having said that, it really is remarkable that Israel is now a nation again. That's worthy of some discussion. But in Scripture, God always calls the Jews to return to the Lord first and then to the land. Okay, mm-hmm. The Lord first and then to the land. Now, I have a standard Reformed view of Romans 11. I believe that Paul prophesies in Romans 11 that the Jews will, in fact, be converted to Christ. They will, in fact, return to him. And just as their disobedience was life for the Gentiles, so their obedience will be life from the dead. It'll be a spectacular Reformation and revival when the Jews are converted. So, having said all that, I am pro-Israel in the same way that, for example, if I look back at the 19th century in the history of the United States, I don't hold to the doctrine of manifest destiny at all, where we were marching toward the Pacific Ocean because mm-hmm. this was clearly mm-hmm. our manifest destiny. I don't buy the doctrine of manifest destiny, but I live in Idaho. Mm-hmm. Right? And Idaho is territory that was sort of settled because of manifest destiny. Mm-hmm. So I'm not a Zionist. I don't think that Israel, unbelieving Israel, has a claim to the land. But for whatever reason in the providence of God, millions of them are there now. Mm-hmm. Right? And they have offered numerous times to strike a deal with their Palestinian adversaries. And the Palestinians have consistently been the ones who said no. Mm-hmm. And so consequently, I think Israel has the right to the land in the same way that any other nation does. Mm-hmm. Right. It's a de facto, they're the de facto occupants. And yes. if the Palestinians didn't want them there, they shouldn't have launched the wars that enabled Israel to take the territory that they took. Mm-hmm. So it used to be that the Golan Heights belonged not to Israel. The West Bank belonged not to Israel. The Gaza did not belong to Israel. And then when the wars against them were launched, all of that territory was conquered by Israel. Mm-hmm. And you can't now say that Israel occupying those territories is the cause of war, because the first war broke out when they didn't have any of those territories. Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay.
So that's the fundamental issue. I'm a friend to Israel. If chaos broke out in the Middle East and I had a chance to get on a plane somewhere and fly to Damascus or fly to Tel Aviv, well, I'd fly to Tel Aviv. Mm-hmm. Israel is a Western country in the middle of a region that has no other Western nations around it. There's a lot more in common with the West there than in other countries. They still need Christ, but basically that's a pragmatic assessment.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that's definitely a much more balanced view than, you know, what you typically get from the dispensational Zionist. So do you think that it would be possible that if there were a great revival amongst Jewish people and specifically in Israel, that could be a sign of the return of Christ if they actually turn to him?
Yes. Okay. I do. Now, as a postmillennialist, I happen to believe that we've got a pretty long road ahead of us. Mm-hmm. I think that we're still in the early church. So I think I happen to believe that we have centuries ahead of us. But when the Jews are converted, I think it's going to be a spectacular revival that will put the Reformation of the 16th century into the shade. Hmm. So I think it's really going to be something. And when that happens, yeah, things could accelerate such that it hastens the coming of the Lord. Yes.
Okay, that's interesting. So what would you say are some of the more common misconceptions about postmillennialism? One thing I've learned as a Baptist is I never trust what people say about someone else's position. I like to ask the person themselves. Right. And so I guess whenever you hear people objecting to it, and what would you say are the common misconceptions?
I would say in the generic evangelical pre-mill world, the most common misconception is that postmillennialists spiritualize the Bible. Mm-hmm. Okay, that we've got this funny, weird hermeneutic that enables us to put the Bible text into a vaporizer and make it misty and spiritual, and we don't take it literally. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so many dispensationalists, and on this point, I say God bless them, dispensational Americans were sort of the rear guard fighting against theological liberalism. Mm-hmm. And they held the line in many, many ways. And dispensationalists sometimes think, when they think that post-mills spiritualize the text, and that's something that liberals do too, they make the mistake of thinking that postmillennialists are liberals in disguise, or, mm-hmm. On the way to liberalism or on the way to a social gospel. But the real issue is it's not a matter of whether you spiritualize the text or not. It's what is your grid or your metric or your key for interpreting texts? Mm-hmm. I would say, is it the newspaper or is it the Old Testament? Okay. Right. If it's the newspaper, then you can say, well, see these locusts with the sting in their tail? Those look like Apache helicopters to me. Mm-hmm. Well, that looks like spiritualizing the text to me. Yeah. It's like you've got the answer key in the newspaper or the mm-hmm. history books. And then you say, well, see these locusts in Revelation remind me of Apache helicopters. But that's not literal interpretation any more than what I do.
Right.
I believe that the symbolism of the book of Revelation, which is a book crammed full of symbolic representations, those symbols ought to be taken from the Old Testament. Okay. And the same thing would go for the little apocalypses in Mark 13, Matthew 24, Luke 17. So just to illustrate this, and this would be an example of what a non-post-mill, a dispensationalist would say, I'm spiritualizing here. Mm-hmm. But I don't think I am. So Jesus says in Matthew 24 that he basically uses collapsing solar system terminology. Mm-hmm. The sun's going to go dark. The moon turns blood red. The stars fall from the sky. What scholars call decreation language. Mm-hmm. Okay. The sky above just disintegrates. Everything falls apart. Now, the dispensationalist looks at that and takes it literally, sees the physical cosmos collapsing. And since that obviously hasn't happened yet, that's got to be in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So on that, I'm a preterist, which comes from the Latin word for preter, which means past.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe that happened in the first century. And someone, I just looked at the night sky last night and it's all still mm-hmm. up there. Well, when Jesus is asked that question and he's answering it, he quotes from Isaiah 13. Okay. When he talks about decreation language, he's quoting from Isaiah 13. You go look that up in Isaiah 13, 13:10, and then you back up and look at 13:1. And it says an oracle concerning the king of Babylon. Okay, so in the original Isaianic place, this was a prophecy that Babylon was going to be judged.
Mm.
Okay, and it was a way of God saying to Babylon, your lights are going to go out.
Mm.
Okay, now as it happens, this kind of decreation language is all through the Old Testament, multiple places. In Isaiah 13, applies to Babylon. Isaiah 34, it applies to Edom. In Ezekiel, it applies to Egypt. Mm-hmm. In Amos, it applies to the northern kingdom of Israel. And in Joel, it applies to the nation of Israel. But it's always talking about the destruction of a nation or a city, right? Mm-hmm. That's the way, that's what it means all the time in the Old Testament. So then Jesus tells the disciples, you see these stones? Not one stone's going to be left on another. This place is going to be flattened. Mm-hmm. And the disciples say, when is this going to happen? What's the sign of your coming? Well, I think it's talking there about his coming in judgment on Jerusalem. And Jesus, in the course of his answer, quotes this judgment language against Babylon and against Edom. And so all the bad things that happened to those cities were going to happen to Israel. So, which is precisely what happened in 70 AD.
Right.
In 70 AD, the Romans came in and flattened the place. And it's ironic for me as a conservative, believing Christian, Orthodox Christian, one of the most telling proofs of the Lord Jesus being a prophet from God was the fact that he repeatedly and specifically predicted what was going to happen to Jerusalem within one generation. Not one generation will pass away until all these things are fulfilled. And when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, you head for the tall grass, you know, all of those things. Mm-hmm. And that, in my mind, vindicates Jesus as the ultimate prophet, the true prophet. Moses said in Deuteronomy that a prophet like me is going to arise. Mm-hmm. And when he comes, you must listen to him. And this is his calling card. The destruction of Jerusalem is his calling card. Now, some of your pre-mill friends might say, at the end of the day, I'm not persuaded. But at least I would like to persuade you of this, that there's an Orthodox post-mill position that takes the Bible as the inerrant word of God that is fully Orthodox and sees these texts in this way.
Yeah. Well, no, that makes sense. And the dispensationalists who want to go ultra literal on Matthew 24 and the stars falling, and that just means they're gone. Well, in Revelation, later in their timeline, you've got a third of them being taken out. So I thought they were already gone.
Yeah.
So obviously there's something symbolic going on there in Matthew 24. So no, that makes sense. And you know, there's a consistency to what you're saying. And one thing that I can't get a lot of people on our side to do is just, whenever they come up with their interpretation of how things are going to play out, to show what is your basis. And it's usually the newspaper, like you said. Yeah. And I like how you gave several examples of previous prophecy. I think you should always look at that as precedent for how you interpret prophecy that you believe is yet to be fulfilled.
Right.
And most people don't do that. So that's very interesting. And it makes a lot of sense. And so with Christian nationalism, which is another thing that a lot of people, when they talk about you, they bring this subject up, and it's something we've been hearing a lot about lately. And I hear certain things about it and I'm like, hey, I like that. That sounds good. I hear other things. I'm like, oh, wait a minute. I don't know about that.
Yeah.
What are some common misconceptions of Christian nationalism?
The most common misconception, the one causing a lot of the freak out, is that Christian nationalism is wanting to build Gilead and put all the women in red dresses. So what they do is they say Christian nationalism, theocracy, and they think of Iran, for example, which is a society run by Muslim clerics. That's what they think of when they think theocracy. But what that actually is ecclesiocracy, the country being run by the church, run by the holy men. Mm-hmm. And people think of Christian nationalism as America being run by a bunch of reformed weird beards, you know, making people do stuff like and chopping off their right hand if they steal something. And that's the spooky, scary thing, right? Mm-hmm. And it's based off of misconception stacked upon misconception stacked upon misconception. So what it boils down to is I'm a Christian and I love my country. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
And as a Christian who loves my country, I want my country to stop doing things that makes God angry. Right? Is it possible for God to be angry with the United States of America? Well, yes. From the beginning of the Bible to the end of the Bible, God doesn't just judge the nation of Israel. For example, the book of Amos is full of judgments against Edom and against Moab. And I just cited one against Babylon. Yeah. And Jonah preached to Nineveh. So God is sovereign over all nations. And nations can anger him by their impudence and insolence and disobedience, so, as we have done. So the Roe decision, under which millions of Americans were unjustly and summarily executed, made God angry. The Obergefell decision, trying to sanctify sodomy and calling it matrimony, that angers God. As a Christian who believes the Bible and as a patriot who believes that our country can anger God, my proposal is that we stop it. Right? Stop, repent of, turn away from the things that make God angry. Now, when I say we repent and turn away, and I believe that we need to call on God, use his name. We need to repent in the name of Jesus Christ. People say, well, if you do that, then that's the slippery slope down to a tyrannical theocracy. That's the red dress territory. That's what people are afraid of. Okay? But let me, if you permit me to cite one of my very favorite Supreme Court decisions. It was in 1892. The Chief Justice was Chief Justice Brewer. And what happened was, and the court case, your viewers can look it up. It's exquisitely named. It's Holy Trinity versus the United States of America. And Holy Trinity was a church in New York City. And Holy Trinity called a new minister to come and serve them. And he was a Brit. So, and they paid his passage over in order for him to take up the position. Well, as it happened, Congress had passed a law prohibiting corporations from paying the passage of workmen to, you know, come over and work on a big, like a railroad project or something like that. They would pay their passage over, employ them for the project, and then release them into the country. You know, it was an immigration problem. So Congress had passed a law prohibiting that. And so some zealous prosecutor went after Holy Trinity for paying the passage of one minister. And this court case went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And I've read the decision, and Brewer, writing the majority decision, they handled the case itself in a very common sense way. It was very, of course, they can call a minister. Don't be silly, right? But then Justice Brewer said, but while we're on the subject, let me tell you all the ways in which the United States is a Christian nation. Okay. And he went back, he just reviewed the history of the colonies, the fundamental orders of Connecticut, the Christianity that was there at the founding, and just walked all the way through. And in this decision said that fundamentally the United States of America is a Christian nation. Okay. Now, here's the thing. This was 1892. This was a century after, or a little over a century after the adoption of the Constitution. Okay. This is 100 years in. Not only is it 100 years in, but that date, 1892, I was born in 1953. 1892 was significantly closer to the day I was born than today is to the day I was born. You and I talking today are 71 years after I was born. And the distance of my birthday from that Supreme Court decision was not that long. So another way of putting this is our apostasy has been pretty rapid. Okay. And what happened was after the Second World War, okay, after the Second World War, there was a lot of revisionist history being imposed on us by our judges, by our judicial system. And things were imposed on the founding that were never there at the founding. Right. So, for example, Thomas Jefferson had written a letter to the Danbury Baptists in which that famous phrase, wall of separation,
right,
is used. Now, the Danbury Baptists were simply, they were interested in keeping the state out of the church. None of them back then were interested in keeping morality and state separate. Who in their right mind would want morality separated from the state? Right. But the Danbury Baptists wanted ecclesiastical government and civil government to each stay in their lane. Thomas Jefferson was all about that, and he wrote them a letter in which he used the wall of separation. Well, then after World War II, judges started that phrase, which had almost never been cited before, began to be cited and imposed on the founding. And we have been taught ad nauseum that the founding fathers were deists. They flat were not. So, for example, at the Constitutional Convention, there were 55 men there, and 50 of them were Trinitarian Orthodox Christians. 50 of the 55. And the two founders that you could argue were deists, Ben Franklin and Thomas Jefferson, and they were, but they were not very good deists, because they believed that God intervened in human affairs, which is not what European deism believed at all. So all of, and then Thomas Jefferson had to hide his unbelief in order to get elected to things. The country was so thoroughly Christian. You asked for the time, and I'm giving you the history of watchmaking here. When the Constitution was adopted in 1789, 9 of the 13 colonies had formal relationships with the Christian denomination. Okay. Now, and some of them were establishment, you know, like in Connecticut and Massachusetts, the Congregational Church was formally established by the state. Now, I happen to believe in the separation of church and state, even at the state level, meaning that I don't think an official Church of Idaho or Church of Connecticut as a denomination is a good idea, but it is not an unconstitutional idea, right? The Constitution made room for that. In South Carolina, what they did is they didn't establish a particular denomination. They went the way I would like to go, which is my version of Christian nationalism. They simply said the Protestant faith is the formal faith of South Carolina. Right. So the tax money didn't go to a particular church like the Presbyterians or the Baptists or the Anglicans, but they simply said, here in South Carolina, we are confessing that Jesus rose from the dead, and we hold to the truths of the Protestant Reformation. Right. And that is the kind of thing that I'm aiming for. That's what I want. Right? And to my mind, that's not scary. Modern Christians ought not to be scared by that, because what I'm after is the kind of arrangement in America that their great-great-grandfather grew up under.
Okay. Yeah. And so, and you mentioned you believe in separation of church and state, which we always talk about how that's a Baptist distinctive. And so you don't believe that goes against Christian nationalism in any way?
Not at all. In fact, I would say it's a Christian nationalist distinctive. Okay. So, for example, there are a lot of streams in Protestant thought, but basically, I'm a Kuyperian, and Abraham Kuyper was a Dutch theologian in the 19th century, and he developed a doctrine that he called sphere sovereignty, which he didn't invent it, but he described it. There are three governments among men that were established directly by God. Okay. They are the government of the family that God established in the Garden of Eden when he gave Eve to Adam. All right. Jesus says, what God has joined together, let no man put asunder. So the family is designed and created by God, which means that since he's the creator of that government, he writes the bylaws. That government has to function within the parameters that God set, because he created it, which means that same-sex mirage is precisely that. It's a mirage.
Right.
You can't say that triangles have four sides because that's not what a triangle is. Mm-hmm. So marriage is designed by God, created by God. That's family government. Then you have church government. A church government is created. Jesus ascended on high, and he gave gifts to men, and he gave first apostles, then prophets, evangelists, pastor, teachers. What he did is he gave church government. Mm-hmm. So the government of the church is a gift from the hand of Jesus Christ as he established his church. And then in Romans 13, it says of the civil magistrate, no authority exists except what has been established by God. Mm-hmm. And if you fight against the civil authority, you're fighting against God. So these three governments have different marching orders. Mm-hmm. They have God writes the bylaws for each, and they're supposed to cooperate with each other, but they're also supposed to stay out of one another's business.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the family is the ministry of health, education, and welfare. The church is the ministry of grace and peace, or if you the ministry of word and sacrament.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then the civil government is the ministry of justice. It's the civil government's job to make it possible for you to walk across town safely at 2 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
That's their job. And so you've got these three distinct entities, and all of them answer to Jesus Christ, but they don't answer to one another. So consequently, when our church gained some notoriety by resisting the COVID shutdowns, for example, when the mm-hmm. when the civil magistrate gets out of their lane and tells you to do something that they have no right to tell you to do, mm-hmm. it's right and proper for the church to resist that.
Mm-hmm.
Or if the elders of the church told a father and a husband that he couldn't buy a Toyota,
mm-hmm.
then the pastors that's overreach. That's not their business. That's not
right.
Right. So everybody's supposed to stay in their lane, and all of us answer to the lordship of Jesus Christ. And that's and so I don't believe that the elders of the church or pastors of the church have the right to declare war or collect the garbage or do the functions mm-hmm. of civil government. If the civil government starts killing babies, the church can speak prophetically and say, you are disobeying the law of God in this mm-hmm. respect. But that's an area where our understanding of the world God made overlaps.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
So a church can't tell a family what kind of haircut to give their kid, but the church can tell a father to stop abusing his kid.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And the same thing is the cops, if the cops are called in a case of child abuse, that's these governments balancing each other. It's
right. Sort
of God's system of checks and balances.
Yeah, no, I think that all makes sense. I think there's so little teaching on that fact that it makes it easy for our government to get out of his lane. And then two, whenever people hear somebody like yourself explaining these things that make a lot of sense, they do try to like scare everybody, and misrepresent it. And that's why, I like hearing it from you yourself, and it makes sense. I agree with it. And I think it's a whole lot better than what we have going on right now.
That's right.
For sure. And good for you for standing against the COVID stuff. That was a big deal with me too. I'm thankful to hear you guys did that. But so another question I had too, though, and it seems to me, according to post-millennial theology, it kind of, it does it. So it demands our world get better before Christ returns. Do you think that's happening? And if it is, in what ways is our world getting better? Because if you listen to a lot of people, I mean, we're going down the toilet.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. So if I could quote the humorist P.J. O'Rourke, he said, I can prove that the world is getting better with one word. And he said, dentistry. Yeah. I remember what it was like going to the dentist when I was a kid. And, so this is the thing. When people hear that postmillennialists think the world is getting better, they assume that it's getting better the same way a rocket ship takes off okay, where it just goes every minute and every way it's higher in altitude. Mm-hmm. It's better in every respect. And that's manifestly not the case, right? Right now, the world, there are certain horrendous things going on in the world as we speak. And there are beautiful, wonderful things going on. There are people taking well-deserved vacations. There are people lounging on the beach, drinking umbrella drinks. And then there are other people who are in the middle of war and chaos,
right? Mm-hmm.
Right. So you look at this planet with 8 billion people on it, and it's a mixed bag. Okay. So instead of saying that postmillennialism views it as taking off like a rocket ship, it'd be better to say it's like walking from Omaha, Nebraska to the west bank of the Rocky Mountains. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you walk up a gradual incline and then down into a valley and then up into the foothills and then down into a valley, then up and then into a canyon and then up further, or it's like five steps forward, three steps back. You know, it's a long, slow, gradual thing. The Reformation in the 16th century was a great advance of the kingdom of God. But then since that time, there have been declensions. We've gone down into some gullies and gulches since then. And we're praying for another Reformation that will garner us a new advance, right? Mm-hmm. So if someone says, do you think that the world is better than it was 2 months ago, I say you can't answer that. I can't mm-hmm. answer that question. Might be worse. But I can say, if you ask yourself this question from the perspective of missions, church planting, and evangelism, are we better off now than we were 500 years ago? Yes. Mm-hmm. Millions of people are following Jesus Christ now.
Mm-hmm.
Million, all over the world. And then you said, well, what about 500 years ago or 1,000 years ago? Now, if you take it in 5-year increments, you'd have to say, I don't know. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But when you get to the 500-year level, I could say, no, there really has been great progress.
Mm-hmm.
And then 1,000 years ago, well, 1500s, it was way better than the time of William the Conqueror. And that time was way better than 500 AD.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to look at it in big enough increments. Another book that I would recommend is Arthur Herman wrote a book called The Idea of Decline. In Western culture, idea of decline in Western history, something like that, by Arthur Herman. And he shows and demonstrates that the idea that everything's falling apart is an idea. It's not an objective data point.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that people bring to their observation of the world. So the newspaperman's adage is, if it bleeds, it leads. Okay. People don't buy newspapers to find out that is in thus and such a place, everybody had a wonderful breakfast and then a nice walk by the lake.
Mm-hmm.
History books are full of turmoil and drama and chaos and wars. Newspapers, the same thing. Your news feed, the same thing. But we have a gravitational pull toward that, and those things actually do happen. So I'm not trying to deny them, but I am saying that there's a bit much bigger picture. A lot more is going on than we tend to think.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. You know, a few years ago, I was in Ireland and I visited a castle that was from the 14th or 15th century, and they were explaining life back then for the rich during that time. And I was like, I'd rather be poor today than rich back in that day. And it really, when you think about it in that way, it does put certain things in perspective. So that's very interesting. Now, another thing that people bring up when you start talking about Christian nationalism and postmillennialism and conquering the world for Christ, they'll talk about this theology it's going to lead to more inquisitions, Spanish inquisitions and things like that. You know, is it possible to possess the world for Christ without bloodshed, or are we going to have to do that?
So, if you're talking about bloodshed, where the Christians mm-hmm. are the persecutors, mm-hmm. I believe that it's possible, yes, for us to be more obedient this time around. Okay. I'm an advocate of what I call Christendom 2.0. Mm-hmm. Christendom 1.0 had some bugs in it. Okay. There were things in Christendom 1.0 that I don't want us to do again. Okay. The Spanish Inquisition being one of them. Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's not do that again. But this is the thing, and this is something that I think will help Christians put this in perspective. And I want to put it in perspective without anybody thinking that I am in any way defending the Spanish Inquisition. Okay. Bad stuff shouldn't have been done. Evil, wicked, bad. Okay. Mm-hmm. But the Spanish Inquisition, over the course of its many years run, killed about 2,000 people. Okay, they killed about 2,000 people. That is Planned Parenthood on a slow afternoon. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is over many years, mm-hmm. and not justifying it at all, but the commies, during the course of in Mao's China and Stalin's Russia, the commies murdered 100 million people. 100 million people. And then someone says, well, we can't risk letting the Christians take charge because of what the Spanish Inquisition did. I'd say you guys are not morally serious, mm-hmm. right? This is not morally serious. Christians, all good-hearted Christians, want to avoid the stake and we want to avoid medieval tortures. Yeah, that's no good. But it was the Reformation that brought about some of those fundamental changes. Mm-hmm. It was the Reformation that first introduced the idea that Christians ought not to be persecuting fellow Christians. Mm-hmm. Okay, that was a Christian development. Liberty of conscience is a Christian development. Mm-hmm. The Westminster Confession of Faith in the 1600s has a chapter on liberty of conscience. There's a great book, I keep quoting, referring books, The Emergence of Liberty in the Modern World by mm-hmm. Douglas Kelly. And he shows how political civic liberty was a child of the Protestant Reformation. Mm-hmm. It was a natural development from it. And so consequently, the people who turned the 20th century into a slaughterhouse, and they did, mm-hmm. ought not to be lecturing Christians about how bloody we are.
I agree. That makes sense. So just a couple more questions real quick. I don't want to keep you too long, but in the premillennial world, a lot of us too that have gone away from dispensationalism, we've learned too that a lot of the explanations of premillennialism, I think, are very foolish. It's very Israel-centered in a lot of ways. But the one passage that none of us can get around, myself included, is Revelation 20. We all think we take that very literally, and that is literal. What would you say premillennialists are missing when it comes to Revelation 20, if that can possibly be answered in a short way? Yeah,
I can give you the short form. Mm-hmm. I'll begin by saying that it's unfortunate that the three positions, pre-mill, amill, and post-mill, are named after a word that occurs one time in the Bible, mm-hmm. And it's in Revelation 20, mm-hmm. millennium, and it's a notoriously difficult chapter in a notoriously difficult book, mm-hmm. right? And then we have all our positions named after what we think about that millennium. The joke is that the millennium is 1,000 years of peace that Christians like to fight about. So in order to answer the question about Revelation 20, I have to sort of zoom out and tell mm-hmm. you that I take Revelation, the book of Revelation, as a whole, with the exception of the last two chapters, in a preterist sense, in a preterist way. And just briefly, these are four different hermeneutics. And you can use the Book of Revelation to distinguish them. So there's the idealist position, where the Book of Revelation is basically a giant parable in the sky, you know, where you you can't keep a good man down, and good triumphs over evil, and make sure to rotate your tires. And you know. So that's the idealist position. Then there's the futurist position, which is the common pre-mill dispensational view, which is that the Book of Revelation is describing all the events at the end of the world. Mm-hmm. Okay. And it's still in our future. It's called futurist because it's in our future.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's the historicist position, which views the Book of Revelation like a prophecy of all of church history from the time of John the Apostle. Is like an unrolling carpet. So a historicist would be able to read Revelation and say, and this is where I find Napoleon Bonaparte.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So they think it's a revelation of the whole shebang.
Right.
And then there's the preterist view, which is my view, which is that I believe the Book of Revelation was written prior to 70 AD, and it's all about the destruction of Jerusalem. Okay. It's about God's divorce of Israel and his marriage to the Christian church, which is the new Jerusalem, the new Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's the basic framework. So consequently, the beast with seven heads, the seven heads, John says, are seven hills and are also seven kings. Well, Rome was famous as the seven-hilled city, just as we say, Chicago is the Windy City, or New York is the Big Apple, or New Orleans is the Big Easy. Rome was the seven-hilled city. And John says, this beast is the seven heads are seven hills. And then he says the seven heads are also seven kings. Five were, one is, and one is to come. And so you count five. I start with Julius Caesar. Countdown. The sixth one is Nero Caesar. And he's I take Nero as the beast, the persecuting beast. And his number is 666. And there are a bunch of things that come together here, but there's a practice called gematria. In English, we have Roman letters and Arabic numerals. So when we're doing math, we do the 1, 2, 3, 4, and we do Roman letters to write prose, for example. Well, the Hebrews didn't do that, the Greeks didn't do that, and the Romans didn't do that. They used letters double duty. All right, so you could look at someone's name and read their name, but you could also do a little toggle switch in your brain and see a row of numbers. Okay, so my name Douglas, the letter D would be number 4, and letter O would be whatever number that is in from the alpha 1. So then in order to find the number of someone's name, you just add up the numbers of their name. Right. And if there was a coin that was minted during Nero's reign that had Neron Kaiser. And if you add up the numeric, if you transliterate that into Hebrew and add up the numbers, it adds up to 666. Okay. So, this is, and I'm just giving you a taste of how preterists handle the Book of Revelation.
Right.
Okay. And all of that is building up to the millennium, which is 1,000 years of peace, which we take as being symbolic of the church age. Okay. The devil is bound. He's not vaporized, but the devil is bound with regard to his ability to deceive the nations. So the devil can not do what he did with Babylon or with Persia. In the Old Testament, you see these great empires that were demonically driven, that were satanically driven. During the church age, I don't think that can happen because the devil is bound, right? With respect to deceiving the nations. And then at the end of that church age, at the end of the millennium, which is not a literal thousand years. It's an extended period of time. Satan is released again. There's a final rebellion, and then the Lord comes. Now, just to be clear, postmillennialists, being people, they have different views on different things. So 19th century postmillennialists frequently took the millennium as the literal 1,000 years at the tail end of the church age. So the millennium was the golden age. It was the church age, and the millennium was a literal 1,000 years at the very tail end of it. Modern postmillennialists tend to take the 1,000 years as the entire church age.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that makes sense. I guess I was probably a little confused with the preterist idea of where it ended. And so on chapter 20, that kind of changes my thing, how I thought about that position a little bit. So that makes sense. So I get final question I want to ask. If I were to go to a postmillennial prophecy conference, what events would they be talking about that are still to come? Is there any kind of tribulation, abomination, desolation, rapture? I guess, what does the future look like?
Yeah. Some postmillennialists, and a number of them, probably still hold to a tribulation, an apostasy, a falling away, things like that. But those events do not have a starring role. They're sideshow issues. Okay. So if you went to a post-mill conference that we were hosting, you would hear about the conversion of the Jews. You'd hear about that's a prophecy that's still to come. You would hear about discipling the nations. You would hear about the Great Commission. You would hear about the nations that need to be opened up to gospel preaching. And you would hear exegetical talks on how to understand passages like Matthew 24, Mark 13. You know, there'd be the exegetical groundwork, but to the extent that they were talking about things yet to come, it would be things like the conversion of the Jews and some of the details at the end of history.
Okay. No, it's very interesting. I love just getting other perspectives and hearing it from them directly rather than hearing somebody on my side talk about it. And I do, like I said, while I've not agreed with everything I've heard you say in some of your interviews and things, there's a lot of things I have agreed with and other things. It's like, well, I got to think about that. I find it very intriguing. And so I do on this program, we try to listen to other perspectives. I think we should be allowed to disagree on prophecy.
And I have to say that I appreciate your approach very, very much.
Well, thank you. Yeah. I understand I'm independent fundamental Baptist. I'm breaking all the rules by being that way. But as somebody who's had a differing opinion, I've been run through the ringer a lot, and I've had so much said about my position that's false. I was like, I wonder if we do that to other people too. And we kind of do. Yeah. So trying to set the example I appreciate you being willing to come on my program. I've seen you on some of the big name shows out there. And so I'm glad that you were humble enough to come here. It does mean a lot. And you've been recommended by many people. And so I know they will appreciate you doing this. So thank you very much. Very interesting. And I wasn't too far from you a couple weeks ago. We drove from Spokane to Kalispell, Montana. Okay. And yeah, so I saw signs for Moscow, Idaho.
80 miles north of us.
Okay. Yeah. So it is beautiful country out there for sure. So,
gorgeous. Yeah.
Well, all right. Well, all right. Thank you so much for your time, and God bless you, and you take care. All right.
Thank you. Blessing.
Well, there you have it, folks. Another fascinating conversation with another fascinating individual. And I really do appreciate him coming on here. Usually if you can get on shows like Tucker Carlson, you don't need to talk to Tommy McMurtry. But I appreciate his willingness to do that. And if you didn't like everything that he said, you know, just please be respectful. Do not be ignorant in the comments and things like that. I just do not believe that that is profitable. And, you know, I don't think I'll do a damage control episode after this. Maybe I'll need to, I guess, if I get creamed enough. But there are positions out there that even if I disagree with them, I can learn things from here and from that perspective. And I think I've already addressed my position on a lot of the things that he referenced where I would disagree with him, like on the writing of Revelation and things like that. But at the end of the day, a lot of these things are very, very difficult to prove one way or the other. And we have very strong opinions on a lot of these things, but we don't always have real proof. And so if Pastor Wilson has his way and evangelizes the world for Christ, I don't really see what that's going to hurt. If his agenda gets put forward and he makes our government better, I really don't see how that's going to hurt. And so I don't know. Even if I don't agree with everything, I just can't hate. I can't hate him for the stuff that he was saying. So if you want to be that way, I get it. But don't apply that standard to me. I don't want to do that. And that was very interesting. So thank you all for watching this. I hope it was a help and a blessing to you. Make sure you like it, share it, and get it out there. This is where the most interesting conversations happen. You will not find it anywhere else. This is where it is, the Spirit of Prophecy podcast. This episode is another example of why this is the podcast that everyone's talking about. And why I say all the time as well, we do not have all the answers here, but we are not afraid to find out what they are. We will get to the bottom of everything that is true. So thank you all for watching this. God bless you. And we will see y'all next time.